Good afternoon and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Mick Rude and I'm a member of the Board of Governors of the Press Club and editor of Biotech Daily, a King Publishing Group newsletter. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you watching on C-SPAN, listening to this program on National Public Radio, or accessing it on the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind our members of some upcoming speakers. On Monday, October 18th, the Prime Minister of Turkey, Tansu Çiller, will speak on Turkish-U.S. relations in the post-Cold War era. On Tuesday, October 19th, Stephen King, author of Cujo and The Shining, will speak about what's a nice guy like you doing writing stuff like this. On Friday, October 22nd, Steve Nabel, president of Cummings Engine of Mexico, and William Bywater, president of the International Union of Electronic, Electrical, Salaried, Machine, and Furniture Workers, will debate the NAFTA agreement. Other upcoming luncheon speakers include a debate between DNC Chairman David Wilhelm and RNC Chairman Haley Barbour. The coordinator of the European Economic Community's African Elephant Project, Ian Douglas-Hamilton. Former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, and I believe that one is sold out. And the president of the National Geographic Society, Gilbert Grosvenor. Audio and video tapes of Press Club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. If you have any questions of our speakers, please write them on the cards provided you at the table and pass them up. I will ask as many as time permits. Now I'd like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly while their names are called. From your right, Peggy Eastman, Washington editor, Medical Publishing Enterprises. Reginald Ryan, Washington editor, Biotechnology Newswatch. Carolyn Lockhead, San Francisco Chronicle. Steve Usden, editor, Global Press and BioCentury. David Wetmore, Acting Director, Office of Governor Pete Wilson. Janet Aker, Managing Editor, The Pink Sheet. Mrs. Adele Binder, our speaker's wife, and passing over our speaker. Christy Wise, a freelance writer and Vice Chairwoman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Diane Spatz, Assignment Editor for Healthcare Reform, Los Angeles Times. Charlotte Grimes of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Tim Beardsley, Scientific American. Michelle Fay Cortez, Bloomberg Business News. Finally, Lee Bowman, Scripps Howard News Service. Also, I'd like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Thornsbury, and Melanie Abdo-Dermott for organizing today's luncheon. They did the work. AmGem is an unusual biotechnology company. It has products on the market, revenue from those products, and substantial net revenues. Please understand, most biotech concerns have no products, take in little revenue, and declare losses on a quarterly basis. Standing tall in an industry still in its infancy, AmGem is the largest biotech company in the world. It's in the Fortune 500, and last year the company took in more than $1 billion in revenue. AmGem represents the promise of a technology that could help make this country healthier and more prosperous going into the 20th century. However, even AmGem faces the uncertainties inherent in biotechnology. Its stock can take roller coaster rides when the market gets good news and bad news. Its scientists faced the possibility of failing in the laboratory with a major product. Its executives must gauge the effect of public opinion on their business. Gordon Binder, who is chairman and CEO of Amgen, will talk today about the impact of President Clinton's health care reform program, the effect it may have on his industry as it tries to finance and develop treatments for the worst of human diseases. But many other questions face Amgen and other biotech companies. Are there any limits on the reach of biotech products or technologies? Could the prices of biotech products make them the province only of the rich? Could the potential of biotechnology one day make it the bastion of those who wish to perfect rather than help the human race? Mr. Binder is a member of the boards of the Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association and the Biotechnology Industry Organization. He has worked for the System Development Corporation and the Ford Motor Company, among others. Ladies and gentlemen, we don't often have business executives speak at the press club. But this is a company and an industry that could have a profound effect on our society. Please welcome Gordon Binder.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you today and a distinct honor to be a guest of the National Press Club. Our question for today is, will biotechnology survive the Clinton health care reforms? The answer to that question depends, of course, on what kind of reforms evolve out of the torturous and tumultuous year-long legislative and political process that has only just begun. And let me say early on, like most biotechnology companies and the pharmaceutical industry, we at Amgen are in full agreement with the overall goals of healthcare reform. There are some things that are broken, and there are some things that need to be fixed. Insurance reforms, inclusion of comprehensive coverage for prescription drugs for the elderly, are just some of the not only laudable, but necessary elements for a new national healthcare plan. But as this debate continues, it's crucial that in the process of reforming 1/7 of this nation's economy, we do not allow the weakening or destruction of an industry whose products hold the promise of improved lives and reduced costs to the overall healthcare system. I am cautiously optimistic that the end result of this process will preserve that promise. Why am I optimistic? Why do I harbor hope? Because biotechnology really works. And because it works, and because it works so well, biotechnology's future is simply too important and too full of potential to be sidetracked by the only policy that could deal it a fatal blow, a policy that includes price controls on breakthrough drugs. The administration has justified this price control system by stating that U.S. drug prices are markedly higher here than they are abroad. Let me say here and now, as far as biotech medicines, that assertion is flat wrong. Most biotech medicines sold in Japan are 2.5 to 3 times their cost in the United States. That's no accident. That's the policy of the Japanese government to support the biotech industry. In Europe, biotech products typically sell for more than they do in this country also. The sad fact is the administration and some journalists use statistics cited by the critics of our industry that are simply false and misleading. A recent column in the Wall Street Journal revealed basic flaws in the way the government has been tracking percentage increases in drug prices. The index excludes older drugs and doesn't take account of generic equivalents in the calculations. As a result, the government shows an increase in drug prices higher than is really the case. As the Washington Post recently pointed out in an editorial, quote, drug prices have not gone up much faster over the past decade than other costs of health care. But drug prices are particularly sensitive because some insurance plans, especially Medicare, do not cover prescriptions, unquote. Let me add, on behalf of the biotechnology industry, our drugs have rarely had price increases at all. Those that have occurred have been less than the rate of inflation. And yet critics of the medicine-producing industries include us in that category and continue to condemn us with faulty numbers based on faulty premises. There's another reason why I'm optimistic that biotech will survive these reforms, and that is because I think that price control proponents will lose this fight. Does anyone really think price controls will work? Have they ever worked in the past? Does anyone really think this Congress will defy logic in the voting public to install something into our healthcare system that has never worked? And I'm optimistic also because there are other signs of recognition of some of these problems. House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt, for example, recently said that the proposed National Health Board, a panel of political appointees with, frankly, awesome power to pass judgment on prices and other mischief, isn't a sure thing for the final version of health care legislation. Let us hope that he is right. That biotechnology products have successfully been brought to market, though relatively few in number, have helped hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions, of patients already to live better, more productive lives. Although our industry has been described as the incubator for most of the progress that will be made in human health in coming decades, the newness of this highly technical industry and the complexity of its products has sheltered it from the kind of exposure given to other technological industries, such as computers and software manufacturing. Our science gained new acclaim this week, however, with the Nobel Prizes for both medicine and chemistry going to four researchers whose discoveries were instrumental in the development of biotechnology. Now, what is this thing, biotechnology, and how is it defined? We at Amgen say that biotechnology is the art and science of using biological technology as a tool to unlock the body's natural secrets. We see that art and that science as a part of the vision we have at Amgen, and the vision held by the industry itself. That vision begins through the eyes of the thousands of scientists working in hundreds of small biotechnology companies all across the country. Each day, these dedicated researchers are making solid progress towards solving the mysteries of the human system. As they work at their lab benches, they diligently and systematically search for the ever-elusive solutions to such complex human ailments as cancer, AIDS, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, diseases which have devastating effects on millions of Americans, both young and old, diseases which contribute significantly to the national health care bill, diseases for which there are no adequate treatments or cures today. Our vision is to find the solutions and cure these diseases. We believe that our industry can do it. It's estimated that the cost of these uncured diseases is some $419 billion annually, nearly half of our total national health care cost. The most costly of all are Alzheimer's, cancer, cardiovascular disease, and surprisingly to some, arthritis. Our vision is an American vision, shared by nearly 100,000 biotechnology industry employees across the United States who go to work each day knowing they are part of the solution. They are part of a healthy and vital and growing industry, an American industry, that leads medical science in such a dramatic way that the competition from the rest of the world is far, far behind. They share the pride that comes with delivering hope and the reality of a healthier future to those who need it most, the patients. The miracles of biotechnology have truly brought the future to the present. Just ask the breast cancer patient who can now receive her chemotherapy on schedule because she is at less risk of developing a life-threatening infection due to this breakthrough biotechnology product. Or ask the elderly patient with chronic kidney failure, who no longer suffers from severely debilitating anemia, and who now has the energy to take his or her grandchild to the zoo, thanks to the relief provided by another breakthrough biotechnology product. Or ask the child who was destined for a very short life of repeated infections, who can, for the first time, run out and play with the neighborhood kids and attend school without fear of catching an infection that could threaten his or her life. There are other equally compelling examples of patients suffering from multiple sclerosis, Gaucher's disease, and others who have already benefited from the miracles of biotechnology. To date, 22 new human medicines have been introduced as a result of biotechnology research and development. Every one of these products was brought to the market by an American company. In other words, the score in this ball game is America 22, all the rest of the countries in the world put together, zero. We're very proud of that, and all of you can be very proud of it, too, as all Americans should be. There are another 130 therapeutics in the pipeline, which are already being tested in humans, and that doesn't even count the many that are in the preclinical phase of development. Many of these will directly produce cures or relief for millions who suffer from the ravages of dread and even exotic diseases. Hundreds of other possible drugs and diagnostics are being researched in biotechnology labs in 47 of the 50 states. This exciting and vibrant biotech industry showed a 17% increase in sales between 1991 and 92. Research and development budget increased 14% to nearly $6 billion. Now employs nearly 100,000 Americans, an increase of better than 23% in 1 year. In biotechnology, the U.S. is number one and nobody is number two. That's not to say that the Europeans and the Japanese are not hard at work. They are, and with great energy and with strong governmental support. As the biotech industry continues to grow, we are confident that it will emerge as a major engine driving the U.S. economy. The U.S. Department of Commerce has estimated that biotechnology will have sales of over $50 billion by the end of this decade. They're including in that the agricultural, chemical, and other uses in addition to pharmaceuticals that the developments of our industry have provided. We in the industry feel biotechnology is on the cutting edge of the American economic reformation of the 90s, unless unintended consequences of reform derail our steady progress. Despite the spectacular breakthroughs in economic growth over the past decade, concern and uncertainty have descended on the industry during the last 8 months. If some of the more dire threats prove out, principally controls over what companies can expect in return for expensive research and development, we have to ask what will be the impact on the American biotechnology industry. Let me cite Amgen's experience as an example of what an unfettered, innovative, and competitive environment can mean in new products and new jobs. Amgen's truly remarkable record of achievement and success is the result of a combination of courage, entrepreneurship, talent, and frankly, a little luck, that combined in the early 1980s with little more than a few good ideas and expertise in gathering together top-ranked scientists into an environment that allowed them to be productive. We then built an enviable record of capital formation. Amgen gained $19 million in private equity financing in its very first financing, at that time a record for a biotechnology company. In total, Amgen had to raise more than $400 million before we sold anything. We could not have raised this money in any other country. It's a great tribute to the American system, the American financial system, that that kind of money is available for this kind of risky investment. The success of Amgen has been a direct result of a studied effort to invest in the future. From a few dedicated scientists in 1981, we now have some 3,000 employees worldwide. Just this year, we moved up more than 100 places on the Fortune 500 list of companies, the basis of sales of more than $1 billion. We are now the largest American-owned biotechnology company and the largest biotechnology company in the world. In 1994, we will spend nearly $250 million on research and development. Our latest research building, a 200,000 square foot R&D center, is a commitment to the people of our nation who face illness and the threat of illness. This building demonstrates our further commitment to the continuing American dominance of this exciting industry and is a symbol of the innovation, energy, and skill of American science and the American worker. This is a risk-heavy business. There are 1,300 biotechnology companies in the U.S. Most are very small, very entrepreneurial. They are research-dominated with more than 50% of their costs going to research and development. As many as 75% of these companies have fewer than 50 employees. Probably fewer than 1% of them are able, as yet in their stage of development, to sell anything. All but a handful of companies simply don't have any product sales. They must fund their research through equity financing and are almost entirely reliant on some private financing and public stock offerings on Wall Street. Despite some flattering news accounts and some political rhetoric, the truth is that our industry as a whole has yet to show a profit. In 1992, our industry, all the companies combined, lost $3.6 billion. Because of the staggering promise of the industry, at least 90% of the nearly $6 billion that we spent on R&D this past year has come from private investors. Even with all the risks and dangers, biotechnology has dramatically demonstrated its potential to become a major element of growth in our nation's strategic effort to meet foreign competition and maintain American dominance in the world economy. The writer and futurist John Nesbitt believes that biotechnology will be to the 21st century what physics and chemistry have been to the 20th century. And the future will be an American future. We have the products, we have the patents, we have the science, we have the markets. In this competitive marketplace, the U.S. is really the only player today. At this point, we should probably rephrase the question for today from will biotechnology survive the Clinton health care reforms to how will biotechnology survive the Clinton health care reforms. The Clinton administration's proposed system of so-called standby or indirect price controls not only would seem to be unduly cumbersome with its new layer of bureaucracy, but is in fact simply unnecessary. Most biotechnology medicines reach the United States market with prices that are determined by the research and development costs, manufacturing costs, marketing costs, and the number of patients who can benefit from the product, and of course the effect of competing products. Biotechnology products are an infinitesimal part of the total healthcare picture. Total drug costs, all kinds of drugs put together, are only about 7% of the total healthcare cost in America. This is a much lower percentage, by the way, than it is in most other countries. Of that 7%, breakthrough biotechnology drugs, the ones singled out for price controls in the proposed healthcare reform, are only between 3 and 4% of that 7%, or in other words, 1/500th of the total cost of the U.S. healthcare system is involved when we talk about breakthrough pharmaceuticals. We've seen in the initial draft version of the Clinton healthcare reform package price controls, mandatory rebates, arbitrary mechanisms that could remove a drug from Medicare, and so on. All of these are measures that can only result in further uncertainty for biotechnology and put further pressure on this young industry's ability to secure the money and to engage in research development of these products. We're also troubled by the concept of global budgets for healthcare. How can we face up to costly cures for AIDS and other anticipated medical needs that might arise in coming years without an unencumbered research and development capability? The fact is, the Clinton reforms as they stand today will not dramatically change the largest producers of patent-protected biotech products such as Amgen or the big fully integrated pharmaceutical companies. But these concerns will surely kill many small research-oriented companies that will simply find raising the money they need to stay alive impossible. The ultimate penalty for a complicated system of controls and rebates and mandates will be the further erosion of competitiveness and entrepreneurship in this vital and creative industry. Why is this? Wall Street understands that government price controls would mean investors' returns on their biopharmaceutical investments will be determined by the unpredictable actions of a few government officials, rather than by competition in the free marketplace, no matter what the drug's actual value to society may be. Now, it's really very simple. Let's suppose each of you had some money and you were going to make an investment. And let's suppose you were offered two choices. You can invest in one industry where some government official will determine profitability, will determine the return on your investment. Or you can invest in another industry where the free market capitalist system will determine profitability of that industry and the return on your investment. Where would you put your money? That's the way Wall Street looks at it. That's the way all investors look at it. And I think they would reach the same conclusion that you would probably reach when they face that choice. The most effective cost control measures that the administration can initiate is to encourage investment and risk-taking in medicines that can cure or knock out Alzheimer's, AIDS, Parkinson's, and other debilitating diseases, costs that could save hundreds of billions of long-term health care costs. But if there is no return on this investment commensurate with the investor's risk, due to some government-set pricing scheme, there will be no new drug for these diseases. An exciting example of this kind of risk-taking and its possible benefits was announced just yesterday by Genzyme, in that it has conducted the first successful clinical trial of cystic fibrosis gene therapy. Now, there are only, and of course, It's a little hard to say only because this is a terrible disease, but there are only 30,000 Americans now suffering from cystic fibrosis. And they're all eagerly waiting the outcome of further clinical trials and the much research that's still needed before they'll be able to be treated. This company has invested $40 million thus far and anticipates spending another $400 million even before the product enters the market. That's about $13,000 per patient just for the R&D. Not the marketing, not the selling, not the G&A, not the manufacturing cost, not the income tax or the sales tax or the property tax or any other cost, just research and development alone. And the private enterprise system is funding every penny of it with no taxpayer money going to make these payments. This is a high-risk industry. And now that we have the threat of price controls on breakthrough drugs, it is even riskier. Common sense would tell us that the public will not stand for policies that impede the development of new medicines and new cures. Let us hope that common sense will prevail. Why? Because biotechnology is the incubator of new products for cures and for diagnostics that will surely be the early detection pillar of cost-effective healthcare that all of us, not just the White House, want to evolve from this debate. And so I say to you, all of you about to embark in this great challenge, in this great debate, do not impose punishing and unnecessary restraints upon biotechnology and medical innovation. Do not cast away the great competitive advantage now held by our country. But do allow biotechnology to compete freely in the marketplace, to develop new cures and new miracles of diagnostics and outcomes to our people now and in the future. Biotechnology will, of course, survive. And that survival will be especially bountiful if we in the industry and those making policy work cooperatively to put together healthcare reforms that benefit the whole without destroying that which has made our industry the wonder of the medical world. Yes, we need universal coverage for all Americans. Yes, we need health insurance that is portable, that can be obtained regardless of pre-existing conditions. Despite all the rhetoric, the best medical care in the world is right here in the United States. Now, we do business directly in 13 countries around the world. I can give you all a piece of advice. If you're going to get sick, seriously sick, do it in the U.S. Don't do it in some other country. Many complain the amount of GNP spent on health care in the U.S. is higher than anywhere else. And that's true. But too many of the critics conveniently ignore the reason why this is true. The U.S. healthcare system simply provides more care, better quality care, to each person than any other country does. Surely we need to control costs. We need prescription drug coverage for senior citizens and many other healthcare changes that most Americans could support. But we cannot destroy what works in our overriding desire to achieve reform. Let us not change just for the sake of change. This nation will be ever grateful if we can put more order and more efficiency into a system that may not be perfect, but is still better than any other in the world. So let us get on with the process. Let us get on with the debate. But let us do it fairly, wisely, and with compassion for those who need it today and for those who need it tomorrow. Thank you very much.
A lot of questions. This questioner asks, isn't there a strong chance that biotech medicines may increase our health care budget? I cite Seraday's for Gaucher's disease, among others, as examples of very expensive biotech medicines.
Well, certainly some new biotech products will produce improved health care and will cost more. I think we don't want to forget, though, that there are many, many cost savings involved in a lot of these products. And I know our own products better than any other. Let me just give you a couple of examples from our case. Epogen, which dialysis patients take, it treats the anemia for them. One-third of its cost is offset by the elimination of blood transfusions. 10% of the U.S. blood supply has been freed up for other uses by this product. It doesn't pay for itself, but it comes close. It helps people go back to work. They pay income tax, they get off welfare, they pay Social Security taxes. If you take all of the costs involved, not just health care costs, you would find that that product costs the U.S. government very little. Case of Neupogen, it's helped things like Duke University Medical Center, Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle, have moved bone marrow transplant from inpatient to outpatient. $200,000 bill yesterday, $50,000 cost today. And the patient is safer and better treated. Now, they won't all save money, but there are a lot of savings here. And I think many of the newer ones may be even more likely to produce savings than some of our earlier drugs, because as we now prioritize our R&D programs, believe me, we're much more sensitive to the cost impact than we were 10 years ago.
How much of U.S. taxpayers' money was spent on the basic research that underlies the development of your products?
Well, I can't tell you specifically for any one product. I can tell you, though, that one of the reasons the U.S. leads the world in biotechnology is because U.S. university research is so extensive and of such high quality. And we do have to thank the federal government and the government of each of our 50 states for the money they give to these universities to support this kind of research. Now, we give money to universities to support research also. In fact, they don't pay us, we pay them. We're actually supporting university research around the world, in Canada, in Germany, in Japan. We go wherever the best scientists are. We try to work with them. We provide financial support to the extent they need it. It was interesting the other day in Japan, one of their leading scientists told us that he would really welcome some financial support from Amgen, because like many other scientists in other countries, his budget had been cut back by the government, and he had some unsupported research that he wanted to do. So we find this same cost squeeze on university research everywhere we go in the world.
I don't think a friend of yours sent this question. About your Epogen statement, it suggests that biotech firms should be free to charge any price, no matter how high, and regardless of cost, of bringing the product to market, as long as the cost of the treatment is less than the cost of hospitalization. Is any other product or service that is marketed in the U.S. priced this way?
Well, I personally think that if we charge a price in this country that's consistent with the prices we charge in other countries, some of which, by the way, are negotiated with the governments of those countries, that's fair, that the world market, the world consumers, the world hospitals, and so on, will take care of this. And my best evidence is the current prices. I think our prices are fair throughout the world. They're consistent. And I think if you look at an industry that's still losing $3.6 billion a year, this industry is hardly price gouging the consumer or the patient.
If the president's proposals are as threatening as you suggest, why are biotech stocks on the rise again?
Well, I think we have to take the right time frame. Biotech stocks are probably half the price they were when the that Spector Price Controls first descended on the industry, and they have rebounded a little bit, but most of that drop is still with us.
Given the administration's and the public's animosity toward the pharmaceutical industry, what can biotech do to differentiate itself to Congress and the public? Since you serve both bio and PMA, that's a tough question. There was a similar question where the person asks, why do you think the pharmaceutical industry has gotten such a public enemy number one reputation?
Well, I don't want to speak for the industry or advise it what to do. I can tell you, though, factually, many in Congress don't like the pharmaceutical industry, and I think that's unfortunate. I think we would do better and have better legislation if it were possible for that industry and Congress to work together more closely. They don't dislike the biotechnology industry, though, I'm happy to say, and we are able to work with them in a pretty cooperative way, and I think that's going to be helpful as the debate unfolds. I think the fact that Medicare doesn't pay for drugs is a big part of it. For somebody over 65, essentially a hospital is free, the doctor is free, the nurse is free, but it's those drugs that I have to pay for that are the problem, and rightly so from their standpoint. That's true, and I think if healthcare reform ends the exclusion of pharmaceuticals from Medicare, that will go a long way toward helping improve the public perception of the classical pharmaceutical industry.
Along that line, this person asks, is there a contradiction between your praise for Clinton's decision to cover prescription drugs, which could be construed as government support, and your criticism of his plan to limit prices? Can you ask for one and not expect the other?
Well, I think if the government wants to provide health care, then it should provide health care, and it should cover all varieties of health care. Whether it should cover health care for every citizen or not is a political issue that I don't want to get into. I can tell you this, though. We sell our product in China. Amgen salesman, Amgen sales manager, and so on. China has eliminated government price controls on pharmaceuticals. They think it's incompatible with the free market. I can remind some of you in the days of U.S. price controls, that we had price controls in everything. Not quite. Price controls in those days did not include price controls on health care, because everybody knew, quote, that it was impractical to put price controls on health care. Right today, just this last week in Italy, the new health minister recommended that Italy drop price controls on pharmaceuticals. Now, maybe they know something that some people in Washington don't. Maybe they know how price controls really work, and maybe they don't like the results that they see. But whatever their reasons, the rest of the world is going the other way, not toward more price controls or toward more government control over pharmaceuticals.
You mentioned Congress. Could you please comment on Congressman Ron Wyden's hearings on the commercial relationship between government-funded universities in private pharmaceutical companies or biotech companies? Should the government participate in those contracts?
Well, I think there are all kinds of private support to universities, and I think that it's something that occurs around the world. It's something that we do. We probably have 200 relationships with various people at universities today. It may be as little as $5,000. It may be to pay half the cost of one lab assistant. It may be a larger program. We have a program with one of the Max Planck Institutes in Germany that is in the seven digits. And interestingly enough, the German government puts up more of the money than we do for that particular work. We believe that the fastest and best way to get technology out of the laboratory, into the companies, and onto the shelves so the patients can have it, is to have very close working relationships between universities and companies. Now, some types of relationships may be more healthy or may be more healthy than others, and maybe there are some that aren't healthy. I believe all of the things we do, though, are in the best interest of the universities. Certainly, we have no private relationships with any university professors. When we write a check, it's to the university, not the person. And we think as long as we do it that way, it's up to the university to decide what to do with the money. If they want to give the professor part of the royalty they get someday, or if they don't want to give the professor part of the royalty or whatever, that should be up to them, we believe, not up to us.
Is the massive funding required for research needed to develop new therapy drugs in jeopardy?
Well, some of it is. We're old enough and successful enough, we can generate the money we need internally from our own operations, as many mature companies can do. But many, many small biotech companies simply live on investor financing. And as long as we have price controls, that financing is in jeopardy. Now, it's a matter of degree. A little bit of price controls, a little bit of financing is lost. A lot of price controls, draconian price controls, a lot of financing will be lost. So it just depends on the type and how much. But I personally believe the U.S. government, even in its own budget, would be better off without price controls on pharmaceuticals.
Speaking of those smaller companies, this questioner wants to know, how could Amgen, a Fortune 500 company, speak for hundreds of tiny startup biotech firms? It strikes me as it might be difficult some days.
Okay. Well, I really don't want to speak for other companies or for an industry, but I can tell you, we used to be one, not that long ago. When I joined Amgen 11 years ago, there were about 50 people in payroll. And we had 6 months' worth of money left. If we hadn't raised some more money during those 6 months, Amgen wouldn't be here and I wouldn't either. So it's been a few years ago, but not that many. Another reason is that we talk to a lot of these people. We want to be their partner. We want to be their licensee, particularly on sales in Europe and Japan and China and elsewhere. And they tell us if they could have a public stock offering, they'd have it. But they can't have it. So what I'm really doing is just passing on what a lot of people are telling me. We speak to the same investment bankers they do, and we get the same story that they get. A few of the stronger ones, those with products further along, can do some financings. It's not zero. But it's a lot less than it was last year, and it's a lot less than it could be or should be.
Going to get a little more technical here. What effect will managed care have on the ability of pharmaceutical biotech companies to recruit patients for clinical trials?
Well, I don't think it'll have any important effect. We recruit patients for clinical trials around the world. We have a number of patients in Canada, which has a single payer system. We have a number of patients in other countries that have various kinds of healthcare systems. One of the things that happens as the system squeezes healthcare providers financially, many of them welcome the idea of doing clinical trials. And many of them, frankly, don't have any compunction about raising their prices to us more than inflation. Just to give you one example, we recently started the very first clinical trial for a hoped-for product called brain-derived neurotrophic factor that might treat Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or the ALS, the so-called Lou Gehrig's disease. They're charging us $25,000 per patient to do the trial. Now, a typical price is only, and I say only, about $10,000 a patient. So they don't exactly line up to do this, but quite a few institutions are pretty eager to do it, particularly at those prices. So we won't have any trouble recruiting patients, no matter what the healthcare system is.
Amgen has been very successful with its product for Medicare renal dialysis market, Epogen. Why is the biotech industry so scared of expanded drug coverage under Medicare?
Well, it really isn't. Both the official policy of BIO, the trade association for the biotechnology companies, and the official position of PMA, the trade association for pharmaceutical companies, both of those are the same. And they are that Medicare should cover pharmaceuticals and every bit of government health care for whatever patient group the government decides to cover should include pharmaceuticals in the coverage.
Genzyme Corporation has gotten some criticism recently for inviting regulators in to see, not regulators, but the staff of the Office of Technology and Assessment, which is an arm of Congress, in to see its operations. Do you think biotech firms need to open their doors to OTA or other government agencies in an attempt to educate them about the industry?
Well, I think, first of all, it's a free country, and any company can open its doors to whoever it wants. I believe, though, that whether it's OMB, whether it's HHS, whether it's the Senate, whoever it is that's going to be a major player in this debate, including all of you, the more you know about biotech, the more you know about our industry, the more you know about our products, the better off we're going to be, the better off this country is going to be, and above all, the better off the patients are going to be. So we talk to a lot of people, we invite a lot of people to come to see us. We'll be doing even more of it the rest of this year and next year than we have in the past.
If you could get price controls or perceived price controls eliminated from the Clinton plan, would you support it?
Well, I think we want to see how it all unfolds. There are competing plans that are being prepared in the Congress. I think the final plan will be an amalgamation of a lot of plans and a lot of ideas. There are certainly quite a number of things in the Clinton plan that we like and we can support. There are things wrong with the healthcare system, and there are things that need to be fixed, and I, for one, am very pleased that the government is heavily into this and has apparently made a commitment that before the next election something will be passed. And I'm looking forward to a lot of these changes.
You mentioned the amount that Amgen spends on R&D. What percentage of your revenues are spent on R&D, and is this typical of other companies?
Well, our percentage for R&D as a percent of sales is around 20%. We're trying to get more efficient in every other area of the company so that we can increase that, and we can probably take it to 21, 22, maybe even 23% over the next several years by achieving more efficiency somewhere else. The rate for American industry as a whole is a small fraction of that. The rate for the classical pharmaceutical industry is somewhat less, but still very high in relation to the typical industry. U.S. government spending, too, by the way, on research in the field of health is a lot bigger than a lot of its spending on other industries. Healthcare is just too important, and we all have to bite this cost bullet if we're ever going to solve these problems.
Here's a parochial question of some interest. Residents of San Diego say they can go across the border to Mexico and buy prescriptions for less than in the U.S. How can you explain that?
Well, I don't think they can do it for biotechnology products. And I can't really explain or get into what's happened with the other pricing, except to say that currency values do change, And so price relationships from country to country do change over time. And some drugs that have been on the market for a long time have had a lot more currency changes to distort these relationships than some other drugs that have been on the market a short time.
Before I ask the last question, I'd like to present you with a certificate of appreciation and a National Press Club mug. All right?
Thank you very much.
Not done yet. One more question. This individual wants to know, why did you choose this forum, i.e. the National Press Club, to express yourself? I had thought the company had traditionally kept a pretty low profile.
Well, that one's probably the easiest question of all. I can't think of a better forum to talk about these kinds of issues and to express our views than this one. And we're very honored and very delighted to be able to come, and we're very glad that so many of you came. I would like to invite those of you who want to have further dialogue with us in other forums, come to visit Amgen and so on, because we would like to get you to know you better and to have more chance to communicate with you. I think whoever selected the mug must have known how much coffee I drink, because it's a perfect gift. Thank you.